Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hey guys, this right here is going to be PALS, the Pediatric Advanced Life Support. And the way it's going to go is I'm going to try to keep it in this order. The systematic approach to the pediatric patient, pediatric shock recognition, pediatric management of shock, recognizing respiratory distress, managing respiratory distress, recognizing cardiac arrest, management of cardiac arrest, arrhythmias, recognition of those arrhythmias, and then management of those arrhythmias. I don't remember PALS being this deep, but again, it's been almost 2 years since I've taken PALS, but it seems like it's a lot more in depth than just your normal ACLS. So this material is coming straight from the book for the course. Just make sure that you guys are reading that material because I did not add some stuff in there like team dynamics or resources for respiratory care or management of the post-cardiac arrest, you know, stuff like that. I didn't include that into this stuff. So if you guys need that or want that, then by all means, read the book or, you know, Google it or whatever. But this right here is going to be the intro for the PALS stuff. So I hope you guys enjoy the Pediatric Advanced Life Support material for the course.
Patient's here.
Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, blood.
He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
For 45 minutes of CPR, no returns for you. You can stop CPR with 6 over.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we are taking on one of the most high-stakes, information-dense, and frankly, clinically relevant topics for anyone working in or preparing for critical care. We're talking about shock management. If you're studying for your mid-surg cert, getting ready for the NCLEX, or you just want to feel confident when that emergency call comes in, this deep dive is absolutely your shortcut.
This is truly where the rubber meets the road. I mean, in clinical practice, the immediate informed action you take when shock is identified, It directly dictates the patient's outcome.
There's no room for hesitation.
None. We know that early intervention, it significantly reduces both morbidity and mortality. And when you're prepping for an exam, you have to know the why behind the what.
Right.
Because the questions aren't just about defining shock. They're about prioritizing immediate nursing interventions based on, you know, the specific cause.
Absolutely. And the sources we've aggregated for this are comprehensive clinical guides.
Yeah.
They really provide the absolute blueprint for rapid assessment and management, tailored to each type of shock. So our mission today is a precise extraction. We're applying what we call the Pareto principle. We're distilling that 20% of clinical data that's going to yield 80% of your mastery.
And we're focusing relentlessly on nursing assessment, those critical facts, and the rapid-fire collaboration that has to happen in those first few minutes.
We're basically converting those dense algorithms into clear, actionable steps.
We will separate the fluid-hungry shocks from the ones where you need to be cautious with fluids.
And the pump failures from the vascular disaster.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the fundamental goals. Why do we intervene the way we do?
You know, if you really understand the core problem in shock, the goals of management just become intuitive.
Okay.
At its heart, shock is just inadequate tissue perfusion and oxygen delivery. So every single thing we do is aimed at reversing that systemic failure.
And what are those specific targets we're aiming for?
Well, goal number one, the primary goal, is to directly improve oxygen delivery. That means optimizing the blood's oxygen content and then improving its flow.
Right.
Second, we have to balance tissue perfusion with metabolic demand. Think about it. If the body is burning through resources faster than we can deliver them, like with a high fever or extreme pain, we're losing the battle.
So we're not just flooding the system with oxygen and fluids, we're also trying to reduce the body's need for them.
Precisely. Third, we need to actively reverse perfusion abnormalities. That might mean getting blood out of the capillary beds where it's pooling, like in distributive shock or, you know, overcoming a physical obstruction.
And the ultimate goal.
The overarching life-saving goal is supporting vital organ function and critically preventing the progression to cardiac arrest.
Because once that happens.
Once cardiac arrest occurs secondary to shock, the prognosis is universally poor. I mean, our window for effective intervention just closes so rapidly.
This might be the single most crucial area for nursing mastery then. Spotting compensated shock. That's where the body is, you know, hiding the problem, fighting hard,
right,
and is buying us time. So what happens when those compensatory mechanisms start to fail?
Mm-hmm.
What are the priority cues that tell us the patient is deteriorating fast?
You absolutely have to recognize that hypotension, a drop in blood pressure, is a late finding. It's a very late finding.
So if you're waiting for that, you're already behind.
You're way behind. If the blood pressure is low, the body has already exhausted its vasoconstrictive reserves, and perfusion to vital organs is severely compromised. Waiting for hypotension is waiting too long.
So what should we be laser focused on before that BP alarm even thinks about sounding?
The signs of failing compensation, the progression toward hypotensive shock. These are your priority manifestations. The first sign is often an escalating and persistent tachycardia.
A heart rate that's just climbing and climbing.
Exactly. If the heart rate is high for their age and it's just getting higher, it means the cardiac output is failing and the body's trying to compensate by just increasing the rate.
And as the body clamps down on the periphery to protect the core, what does that do to the pulses?
You'll see a dramatic contrast. You'll get diminishing or even absent peripheral pulses, and at the same time, weakening central pulses. This is a major sign that the systemic vascular resistance, the SVR, is trying to climb, but the pump volume just isn't there.
And you also mentioned pulse pressure.
Yes. You have to monitor for a narrowing pulse pressure. That's the gap between your systolic and diastolic. A narrow pulse pressure, say less than 20 mmHg, indicates intense peripheral vasoconstriction.
That physical assessment is just non-negotiable. Cold, clammy skin. That's the classic sign, right?
Yes. Cold distal extremities with a prolonged capillary refill. Anything greater than 2 seconds is a giant red flag. If it takes 3, 4, 5 seconds for color to return, perfusion is failing.
And what about neurologically?
And this is perhaps the most concerning for the brain. A decreasing level of consciousness. Confusion, lethargy, decreased responsiveness. That means cerebral perfusion is dropping. These are the trends that demand immediate intervention, no matter what that blood pressure reading says.
Okay, so with those warning signs in mind, our treatment strategies are all about restoring that blood flow and oxygenation.
Exactly. 4 core strategies.
Let's start with oxygen content. We need to maximize the vehicle carrying the oxygen, right? The hemoglobin.
Strategy 1, optimizing O2 content. This means immediate administration of a high concentration of O2, usually 100% via a non-rebreathing mask.
And if that's not enough?
If the patient has a low hemoglobin, maybe from a hemorrhage, we have to quickly administer packed red blood cells, PRBCs, because hemoglobin determines your oxygen-carrying capacity. And if ventilation itself is the issue, we move quickly to mechanical ventilation.
Strategy 2 involves flow and volume.
Improving volume and distribution of cardiac output. This is where your fluid boluses come in.
Oh.
We're either addressing a true volume deficit, like in hypovolemia, or a relative one, like in distributive shock.
And if fluids don't work?
Then we move to vasoactive agents to fine-tune contractility. Those are inotropes. Or the vessel tone itself with vasopressors.
Okay, strategy 3 is minimizing demand.
This is a crucial point. Reducing O2 demand, shock states increase your metabolic needs because of increased work of breathing, anxiety, pain, fever.
So it's a vicious cycle.
It is. So a core intervention is controlling those factors. We use analgesia, anxiolytics, antipyretics. Sometimes just putting a patient on a ventilator drastically reduces their metabolic burden from breathing.
And finally, strategy 4, correcting the chemistry.
Correcting metabolic derangements. As the body shifts to anaerobic metabolism, acid builds up, glucose gets depleted, electrolytes shift all over the place. These chemical imbalances, which we'll get into, they have to be corrected because they directly impair cardiac contractility and how well our life-saving drugs work.
All right, let's move into the hands-on section. When you walk into the room of a patient in shock, what are the first steps, the ones that happen almost at the same time?
Right. We assess, monitor, and intervene, often concurrently. First, let's talk positioning. If the patient is stable and comfortable, we can just leave them be. But if they're unstable or hypotensive, they need to be placed supine,
flat
on their back, unless this really compromises their ability to breathe.
Why supine specifically?
It just promotes venous return to the heart. It maximizes the efficiency of whatever blood volume we do have. And here's a key detail for your exam. In specific cases, like neurogenic shock, positioning the patient flat or even slightly head down can significantly help improve that lost venous return.
Good to know. Okay, next up, airway and oxygenation.
We jump immediately to supplemental O2, high concentration, aim for 100%. If their work of breathing is increasing, if they look like they're tiring out, or if they have that altered mental status,
we need to take over.
We have to move fast. The shift to mechanical ventilation, either non-invasive like CPAP or invasive intubation, must be rapid. Fatigue and shock is lethal.
And then vascular access. This is always a point of stress in the ER or ICU. How long do we spend trying to get a peripheral IV before we move on?
You do not waste time. For compensated shock, sure, a peripheral IV is fine. But for any patient in hypotensive shock, or if you can't get peripheral access within, say, 90 seconds or 2 attempts.
What's the move?
Immediate intraosseous access. An IO is mandatory.
Drill into the bone.
Yes. Perfusion is poor. The veins are collapsed. IO access into the tibia or femur is rapid, it's reliable, and it's just as effective as a central line for rapid fluid and drug delivery. This single step can separate a good outcome from a poor one.
With access secured, we move to fluid.
Yes. Isotonic crystalloids, either normal saline S or lactated ringers LR. These are the workhorses.
The high yield number we all need to have memorized is the standard bolus rate.
20 millikilograms over 5 to 20 minutes. But the clock is crucial here. For severe hypovolemic or septic shock, you are pushing that fluid rapidly. You're aiming for that 5 to 10 minute window. This is where the nurse's skill and delivery is really tested.
And here comes the critical exception, the smallest detail that prevents a catastrophe.
Cardiogenic shock. If we even suspect the pump is failing, giving a huge rapid bolus will drown the lungs in fluid.
So what's the adjustment?
The bolus is smaller and it's slower. 5 to 10 millikilograms over 10 to 20 minutes. The goal is to gently test the heart's response without causing pulmonary edema.
Let's talk about the physics of that. As you mentioned, a standard IV pump is way too slow. If a patient weighs 50 kilograms, a 20 millikilogram bolus is a full liter. How does a nurse get a liter of fluid into a patient in 10 minutes?
This is hands-on nursing. It's not passive. You have to use a large bore IV or that IO catheter. You need a pressure bag, a specialized sleeve that you inflate around the fluid bag, and it physically compresses it, forcing the fluid into the patient.
And if you don't have one?
If a pressure bag isn't right there, you use 30 or 60 milliliter syringes to manually push the fluid through a stopcock directly into the line. It's labor intensive, it's tiring, but it's the only way to get true bolus rates of thousands of ml per hour that you need for resuscitation. Relying on a standard pump during active shock is just not enough.
The moment that fluid starts flowing, the continuous assessment begins. We're looking for trends, not single snapshots, right?
Right.
Because no single parameter confirms that you're resuscitating them adequately.
That's right. And you reassess after every single fluid bolus.
So what are the key positive changes we're looking for after a bolus?
We want to see those signs of compensation resolving. That means the heart rate should start declining toward normal limits. We want peripheral pulses to strengthen and become less bounding. Capillary refill should shorten to less than 2 seconds. The skin should warm up.
And blood pressure.
Blood pressure should increase toward a normal range, but you have to remember, BP accuracy is really compromised when perfusion is poor. So don't hang your hat on that alone.
And our key indicator for end organ perfusion.
Yeah.
The kidneys.
Exactly. Urine output is a direct measure of renal perfusion and adequate flow. For infants and young children, we're aiming for 1.5 to 2 millipace CHR. For older kids and adolescents, about 1 LOK CHR. If urine output is dropping, or zero, anuria, hypoperfusion is ongoing.
What about the negative trends? What tells us to stop the fluids?
You're looking for signs of volume overload, especially in the lungs. The development of crackles or rails or a sudden dramatic increase in the work of breathing suggests pulmonary edema is developing.
And that's the signal to stop.
That is the signal to halt the crystalloids and reconsider the cause. Mm-hmm. Maybe we missed a cardiac component and a foundational exam fact here. Because assessment relies on so many parameters, remember that hypotension is a very late, very grave sign. Relying only on BP can be really misleading.
Let's shift to the body's chemistry during shock. The failure to deliver oxygen just turns the internal environment toxic. What are the four high-yield metabolic complications we have to anticipate?
Hypoglycemia, hypocalcemia, hyperkalemia, and severe metabolic acidosis, lactic acidosis. And all four of them actively make myocardial function worse.
Hypoglycemia. Why is low blood sugar such a danger here?
Well, glucose is the brain's primary fuel, and the heart muscle relies on it for consistent energy. In shock, especially septic shock, the body just burns through its glycogen stores so quickly. Untreated hypoglycemia can cause irreversible brain injury and seizures. It has to be ruled out instantly.
Okay, and hypocalcemia, low calcium, that seems a little less intuitive than low sugar.
Calcium is absolutely essential for smooth muscle contraction. That includes the heart and the blood vessels, what we call vasomotor tone. So hypocalcemia, low ionized calcium, significantly reduces your cardiac output, and you frequently see it after large volume blood transfusions.
Why is that?
Because the citrate preservative they use in packed red blood cells binds to the patient's calcium, which lowers the free active calcium levels. It's a key nursing consideration when you're transfusing blood rapidly.
So this leads us to mandatory nursing actions.
Absolutely. A rapid point-of-care glucose check is non-negotiable for any critically ill patient who presents with shock or altered mental status.
And if we find it's low, how do we intervene?
We give dextrose, D25W or D10W, depending on the patient's size. But here's that smallest detail that prevents a new crisis. Never rapidly infuse large volumes of concentrated dextrose fluids if it's not clinically indicated.
Why not? What's the risk?
If you dump highly concentrated sugar in rapidly, it creates hyperosmolarity in the bloodstream. This pulls fluid out of the cells, causes diuresis, and can actually lead to dehydration and severe electrolyte shifts, especially hyponatremia. So we treat the low glucose carefully, not carelessly.
Okay, now metabolic acidosis, the result of that anaerobic metabolism. Lactic acid buildup is the defining feature. How does the nurse manage that?
The primary intervention is always, always to restore tissue perfusion. If we can get oxygen flowing again, the body will start making lactic acid. Simple as that.
But what if it's really profound?
If the acidosis is so profound, with a very low pH, that it's impairing vital function so the heart can't contract effectively or the vasopressors aren't working, we might use buffer therapy.
That means sodium bicarbonate.
Yes, but sodium bicarb is a temporary measure. It's a bridge. It buffers the excess hydrogen ions, which buys us time. But it only works until the primary issue, which is perfusion, is corrected through fluids and drugs, or until ventilation is optimized to blow off the CO2 it creates.
Let's review the lab studies that guide our therapy, starting with the CBC.
Complete blood count. Look at the hemoglobin and hematocrit. If HGB and HDAT are decreased, it suggests hemorrhage or hemodilution.
The intervention there is obvious.
Right. Control the bleeding, maximize O2, transfuse PRBCs. On the other hand, an increased white blood cell count, WBC, immediately makes you suspicious of sepsis. That means you need to get cultures and start antibiotics fast.
Next, lactate. This is the gold standard for tracking hypoperfusion, isn't it?
It is. Elevated lactate is the product of anaerobic metabolism. The intervention is to improve tissue perfusion. But the critical application for the nurse is serial monitoring.
Watching the trend.
Exactly. We watch for lactate clearance. If the lactate level is falling, our resuscitation is working. If it stays high, we need to escalate therapy, maybe change our agents, or reassess the source of the shock. Persistent hyperlactatemia is a sign of refractory shock, and it carries a very poor prognosis.
We mentioned acidosis. That's tracked on the ABG.
Arterial blood gas. A decreased pH in bicarbonate confirms acidosis. We also look at the anion gap. If it's widened, that helps confirm it's from metabolic acid production, like lactic acid. Intervention is fluids, ventilation support, and maybe that buffer therapy we talked about.
And finally, the more advanced concept, SCVO2.
SCVO2, or central venous oxygen saturation. This measures how much oxygen is left in the blood returning to the heart. A low SCVO2, typically less than 70%, means tissues are extracting too much oxygen because delivery is inadequate.
So you need to increase delivery.
increased delivery. Transfuse blood, increase cardiac output. Interestingly, though, a high SCVO2 over 70% can also be a problem. You often see that in warm septic shock where the tissues can't effectively use the oxygen being delivered. It's a maldistribution problem.
Okay, let's do a deep dive into hypovolemic shock, the volume issue.
Hypovolemic shock is the most frequent type you'll see, and it results from a really simple, direct problem. Not enough intravascular volume. Because the container is the right size, but the volume inside is low, it's usually highly responsive to fluids.
And the causes are divided into non-hemorrhagic and hemorrhagic.
Non-hemorrhagic means you're losing fluid without losing red blood cells. Think GI losses like vomiting and diarrhea, big fluid shifts from burns, DKA with its osmotic diuresis or diabetes insipidus.
And hemorrhagic.
Hemorrhagic is just acute blood loss, usually from trauma. The key difference in management, though the initial fluids are the same, is the rapid need for blood products in the hemorrhagic type.
Since non-hemorrhagic shock is often preceded by dehydration, let's analyze the progression of those clinical signs. This is where nursing assessment really guides what you need to do first.
We use the estimated percentage of weight loss as a marker for severity. Mild dehydration, maybe 5% loss, often just presents with slightly dry mucous membranes, maybe they're thirsty, slight oliguria.
What was the diagnostic pitfall there? A common mistake.
The pitfall is assuming one sign is definitive. For example, a child might have dry mucous membranes just because they're mouth breathing from a stuffy nose. You have to combine these cues. And skin turgor is notoriously unreliable in an obese patient.
Right. Moving to moderate dehydration, about 10% loss, now we're seeing clear physical signs.
Yes, the classic signs start to appear. Poor skin turgor, or skin tenting, a sunken fontanelle in infants, marked oliguria, and that increasing tachycardia. You might also see quiet tachypnea, which is the body trying to blow off CO2 to compensate for a developing metabolic acidosis.
And then the life-threatening stage. Yeah. Severe dehydration, 15% loss or more.
This is compensated shock on the verge of complete failure. You should expect marked tachycardia, weak or absent peripheral pulses, anuria, no urine output, and then those late signs we talked about, a narrow pulse pressure, and eventually altered mental status and hypotension. Intervention here has to be immediate IV or IO access and rapid fluid bolusing.
Focusing now on blood loss. Hemorrhagic shock. The initial management is still that 20 milliuki NS or LR bolus repeated. But when do we stop relying just on crystalloids?
You can give up to about 3 boluses, so 60 milliuki UA total, before you have to seriously consider the patient refractory and move on to blood products.
Let's explain the 3 mll to 1 ml rule. This is such a critical concept for trauma and hemorrhagic shock. Why do we need 3 times the crystalloid volume for every unit of blood lost?
It's all about where the fluid goes. Isotonic crystalloids, like normal saline, they don't stay in the blood vessels.
Right, they leak out.
They distribute rapidly throughout the entire extracellular space, which includes the interstitial space. Only about a third of what you give actually stays in the vessels after 30 minutes. So, to effectively replace 1 mmol of lost blood volume, you have to infuse 3 mmol of crystalloid just to make sure enough stays inside the vessels to raise the blood pressure.
So when do we make the switch to blood?
If hypotension persists, despite those initial boluses, we immediately switch to packed red blood cells, PRBCs. We give a 10 mmHg bolus. Blood is critical because it replaces both the volume and the oxygen carrying capacity.
What about the details on emergency blood administration, the blood type?
If the patient is bleeding out and unstable, you can't wait for a crossmatch. You use universal donor blood. Type O negative is what we prioritize for females of childbearing age because of rhesus factor concerns. For everyone else, O negative or O positive can be used. If the hypotension is severe and they're still bleeding, you use unmatched blood immediately. You prioritize saving their life over the small risk of a reaction.
Okay, let's move on to distributive shock.
Yep.
The vessel issue. This is the opposite scenario, right?
Yeah.
The volume is okay, but the container is just too big.
Exactly. Massive vasodilation has expanded the vascular space, which leads to a relative hypovolemia. Septic shock is the most common and dangerous example.
So with septic shock, what's happening pathophysiologically?
It's an overwhelming systemic inflammatory response to an infection. Inflammatory mediators are released, leading to massive vasodilation, which gives you a low SVR capillary leak, so fluid shifts out of the vessels, and sometimes it directly depresses the myocardium. Our goals are comprehensive: restore stability, support the organs, and control the infection.
This sounds like it demands rapid integrated care. What does that interprofessional management look like in the first hour?
It's a synchronized dance. The MD or DO is focused on diagnosis, source control, titrating drugs. Nursing is the absolute driver, securing access, delivering rapid fluids, initiating monitoring, making sure drugs are given on time.
And pharmacy.
Pharmacy has to ensure those crucial antibiotics and vasoactive agents are mixed and immediately available. And you need early subspecialty consultation, infectious disease, critical care to make sure the treatment plan is comprehensive, especially if the shock isn't responding.
So let's get into the nursing management. The first hour bundle is basically the law here.
The urgency just cannot be overstated.
So what are the interventions that have to happen immediately, no matter where the patient is?
You have to recognize the signs altered mental status, perfusion changes, temperature dysregulation, which can be either very high or surprisingly low.
Right.
Then you secure access. You draw blood cultures and labs immediately. But the most time-sensitive, life-saving intervention is administering adequate, broad-spectrum antibiotics within the first hour of recognition. Don't delay antibiotics waiting for test results. You treat empirically.
And fluid resuscitation remains aggressive.
Yes. We start the 20 millidilligal D isotonic crystalloid boluses, and we repeat them. But you must reassess for signs of overload, those crackles between each bolus. It is very common for children in septic shock to need 40 to 60 millidilligers, sometimes more, in that first hour.
So what defines fluid refractory shock and sepsis, and what's the immediate nursing intervention then?
If the shock persists despite 40 to 60 millidilligers of crystalloids, it is by definition fluid refractory. The intervention is immediate initiation of vasoactive drug therapy vasopressors. And crucially, you have to consider hydrocortisone administration if you suspect adrenal insufficiency.
Especially in patients with a history of chronic steroid use.
Especially then, yeah.
Okay, the choice of vasoactive agent is really high yield because it depends on the clinical presentation. Are they cold or warm?
This is a classic test question. Cold shock means the patient has poor peripheral perfusion, cold extremities, and often low cardiac output. This usually suggests a severely depressed myocardium or intense vasoconstriction, leading to poor systemic flow.
And for that, the preferred agent is?
Epinephrine.
Why epinephrine specifically for cold shock?
Epinephrine is a balanced drug. It stimulates both alpha-adrenergic receptors, which causes vasoconstriction and raises SVR, and beta-adrenergic receptors, which gives you positive inotropic effects, increasing contractility.
So it hits both problems.
It addresses both the pump failure and the loss of tone, making it ideal for that cold shock state.
And then we have warm shock.
Warm shock is often seen in early sepsis. The extremities are warm, cap refill might even be brisk, but the blood pressure is low and the SCVO2 is often high. This points to profound vasodilation and maldistribution of flow.
So the problem is vascular collapse.
It is. So the preferred agent here is norepinephrine.
Which is known as a pure pressor, right?
That's right. Norepinephrine is a powerful alpha-adrenergic agonist. It primarily causes vasoconstriction, which dramatically increases SVR to combat that massive vasodilation without significantly jacking up myocardial oxygen consumption like a powerful inotrope might. We use it to regain vascular tone.
And if both of those primary agents fail, what are the next lines of defense?
If the shock is refractory to both fluid and norepinephrine, we might add vasopressin. It's a non-adrenergic pressor that works on different receptors to increase SVR. And if myocardial dysfunction is clearly evident, the pump is failing, we might use milrinone.
And what's unique about milrinone?
Milrinone is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. It enhances contractility, so it's an inotrope, but it also acts as a powerful vasodilator, which reduces afterload. This unique profile is excellent for improving heart function without forcing it to pump against extreme pressure.
Okay, switching gears to another distributive issue, anaphylactic shock. This is life-threatening because of that rapid release of mediators. What is the non-negotiable immediate first-line intervention?
Epinephrine. It has to be given immediately, usually IM in the vastus lateralis, to slow mediator release, reverse bronchospasm, and stabilize the vessels. For severe sustained hypotension, a low-dose IV epinephrine infusion is started to maintain perfusion.
And beyond epinephrine, what does the rest of the medication approach look like?
We aim to control all the subsequent effects. So albuterol for bronchospasm. We use antihistamines, both H1 blockers like diphenhydramine and H2 blockers like ranitidine, because the combination is highly effective.
And corticosteroids.
Finally, corticosteroids like methylprednisolone are given, not for the acute reversal, but to prevent the dangerous and unpredictable late-phase symptoms that can occur hours after the initial reaction seems to have resolved.
And fluid replacement is still needed here because of the capillary leak, correct?
Absolutely. The vasodilation and capillary leak lead to a significant relative hypovolemia, so those 20 mLKG NSLR boluses are necessary. And the key education point for the family and for your exam is that risk of a biphasic reaction. About 25 to 30% of patients experience these late symptoms, which means they need prolonged monitoring, even if they look stable initially.
Okay, last one for distributive. Neurogenic shock.
Neurogenic shock, usually from a high spinal cord injury, is unique because of its effect on the sympathetic nervous system. You get that loss of vascular tone, but it's compounded by the loss of cardiac accelerator function.
And this gives us that classic triad of manifestations.
Hypotension, a wide pulse pressure, and critically, bradycardia, a slow heart rate. This is a sharp contrast to the compensatory tachycardia you see in almost every other type of shock.
So interventions focus on volume first and then replacing that lost tone.
Right. We start with a trial of isotonic crystalloid fluids to make sure any hypovolemia is addressed. If it's fluid refractory, we need potent vasopressors, norepinephrine or epinephrine, to artificially restore that systemic vascular tone. And a vital nursing point for these patients is temperature regulation. They lose the ability to vasoconstrict or vasodilate to maintain core temp, so you often need aggressive supplementary warming or cooling.
We shift now to cardiogenic and obstructive shock. Let's start with cardiogenic. This is a fundamental failure of the pump.
It is. It's a failure of the myocardial pump to generate adequate cardiac output, usually from cardiomyopathy, severe congenital heart disease, arrhythmias. Something wrong with the heart muscle itself.
And what's happening pathophysiologically?
The output is low, so pressure builds up in the venous system because the pump can't push it forward. Clinically, you see signs of systemic venous congestion, rails and crackles from pulmonary edema, jugular venous distension, or JDD, and hepatomegaly, an enlarged liver from all that backup.
Given that backup, our fluid strategy has to change completely. No more 20 mKG boluses.
Absolutely not. Cautious fluid administration is mandatory. Boluses are smaller and slower, 5 to 10 mKG administered over 10 to 20 minutes. And the nurse has to be listening for those signs of pulmonary edema continuously. If you hear crackles developing, you stop the fluid immediately. The risk of drowning the lungs is just too high.
So if we can't use aggressive fluids, we have to rely on medications to fix the mechanics.
We use medications to reduce the heart's workload and boost its contractility. Diuretics to reduce preload and congestion. Vasodilators to reduce afterload, the pressure the heart pumps against. And inotropes like dopamine, dobutamine, milrinone, or epinephrine are used to increase contractility.
And milrinone seems to be a favorite here too.
It is, because it helps the pump and eases the afterload at the same time.
Interprofessional management here involves immediate consultation, I assume.
Early consultation with pediatric critical care and cardiology is non-negotiable. If the patient is refractory to maximum drug therapy, mechanical support like ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, becomes the definitive treatment.
Okay, now obstructive shock.
Yeah.
A physical blockage.
Right. The pump works, the volume might be fine, but there is a physical impedance to flow, reducing venous return or cardiac outflow.
Examples being?
Tension pneumothorax, cardiac tamponade, a massive pulmonary embolism, and certain ductal-dependent congenital heart lesions. The management principle is simple. Identify and remove the obstruction fast. An initial fluid bolus might be attempted, but it's secondary to the definitive intervention.
So delaying treatment to push fluids is a mistake.
A huge mistake.
Let's focus on those two immediate life-saving interventions. First, tension pneumothorax.
Air accumulates, it compresses the lung, and it pushes the entire mediastinum, including the vena cava, over to the other side. Venous return just plummets, and shock ensues rapidly.
And the intervention is immediate needle decompression.
Yeah.
Where exactly is the nurse aiming?
You use an 18 to 20 gauge catheter, and you insert it over the rib at the top of the child's third rib in the midclavicular line, or the second intercostal space. This is an emergency procedure that releases that trapped air and immediately restores venous return.
And the most critical point.
This intervention should not wait for a chest X-ray confirmation. Clinical suspicion based on unilateral breath sounds and tracheal deviation is enough to act. This is followed by a formal chest tube, of course.
Second, cardiac tamponade.
Fluid around the heart squeezes the ventricles, preventing them from filling. The intervention is pericardiocentesis, draining the fluid from the pericardial sac.
Okay, and lastly, the unique one, ductal-dependent lesions.
This is a unique form of obstructive shock seen in newborns. Their circulation relies on the patent ductus arteriosus, the PDA. If it closes, either systemic or pulmonary blood flow is catastrophically blocked.
And this requires a specific drug to keep that ductus open.
An immediate continuous infusion of prostaglandin E or PGE. PGE is a potent vasodilator that maintains the patency of the ductus, and it can often reverse severe shock symptoms within minutes, buying time until surgery is possible. A nurse has to have this ready immediately if this diagnosis is even suspected.
All right, we have covered a massive amount of material. This final summary is designed to be your rapid recall tool. We'll focus on the core defect, the fluid rule, the vasoactive priority, and the single most critical nursing action for each type.
Let's synthesize these high-yield facts.
Let's start with general shock.
The core defect is inadequate tissue perfusion. Fluid management is a 20 mL KGNG NSLR bolus, repeat as needed. Vasoactive agents are used when it's fluid refractory, and the nursing priority cue is frequent reassessment after every bolus. Remember, hypotension is a late sign.
Hypovolemic shock.
The defect is volume loss. Fluid management is a rapid 20 mL QAG bolus, using that 3-to-1 crystalloid to blood loss rule. Vasopressors are generally not indicated. And the nursing priority is IO access if peripheral is delayed and transfuse PRBCs early if it's hemorrhagic.
Septic shock. Distributive.
The defect is massive vasodilation and maldistribution. Fluid management is aggressive boluses, often 40-60 mL QAG plus antibiotics. Vasoactive priority is epinephrine for cold shock, norepinephrine for warm shock. And the nursing priority is antibiotics within 1 hour, and consider hydrocortisone.
Cardiogenic shock.
Defect is pump failure, myocardial dysfunction. Fluid management is cautious, slow, small boluses. 5-10 mL QAG over 10-20 minutes. Vasoactive priority is inotropes like milrinone or dobutamine. And the nursing priority is to monitor for pulmonary edema, those crackles, and stop fluids immediately if you hear them.
And finally, obstructive shock.
The defect is a physical blockage. Fluid management is an optional initial bolus followed by definitive treatment. Vasoactives are not applicable. And the nursing priority is immediate needle decompression for attention pneumothorax, or PGE, for ductal-dependent lesions.
That table is the ultimate clinical roadmap. It really separates the push-fluid hard scenarios from the hold-the-fluid scenarios. Knowing that 5 to 10 mL QO exception for cardiogenic shock is just essential to pass those scenario-based exam questions. We've navigated the complexities of shock management, prioritizing the nursing implications and the precise knowledge you need to intervene effectively and pass your critical care exams. Remember the urgency of early intervention, the power of IO access, and the absolute necessity of reevaluating that fluid strategy after every single bolus.
You know, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the rapid shift from compensated to hypotensive shock is the single most crucial trend the nurse must anticipate and intervene on. It means you have to be ahead of the curve, constantly checking those perfusion parameters, cap refill, pulses, mental status, not just the BP.
And to wrap up with that final advanced detail that often separates the expert from the novice, the hydrocortisone question in sepsis.
That's the key clinical pearl that often determines the outcome in a fluid refractory septic patient. If a patient is severely septic and their blood pressure is failing despite aggressive fluid resuscitation and they're already on a vasopressor, you have to consider adrenal insufficiency.
Especially with that history of steroid use.
Exactly. If they have a history of chronic steroid use or features of an adrenal crisis, giving them stress dose hydrocortisone is required. If you fail to address this relative lack of their own endogenous steroids, the vasopressors we're relying on will be ineffective and the patient will continue to decline. So keep hydrocortisone in your mental checklist for refractory septic shock.
A perfect high-stakes final thought. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into shock management. You are now armed with the knowledge to make those life-saving priority decisions. Go ace that exam.